Welcome to the Salem Baptist Church Podcast.
You have probably seen that video 100 times. It's been on the news, and I think I borrowed it from WRAL. But I love that video, and this week I've watched it myself several times a day, and it's just awesome how the boy is sparring with his dad and doesn't know who it is. And I don't know if you caught it, but as soon as the dad speaks, the son recognizes his name and starts to pull the blindfold off because he knows his father's voice. And did you see his face as he rushes to his dad? And then even as they sit together after that, you could tell the kid had been crying the whole time, and they calmed him down to shoot the video. That's what homecoming is about. That's what rejoicing is about. That's what returning home is about. We've become accustomed to pictures of men and women returning home from deployment, and it reminds us of the difficulty of separation. It reminds us of the joy of reunion. We look forward to things all the time. We look forward to Christmas, to birthdays, to weddings, to births. My oldest son, Mark, is going to be married next month, and it seems like most of what we talk about schedule-wise revolves around that. You know, can we do this? Can we do that? What day is this? What day is that? It starts to consume us. And the closer we get, the more we'll talk about it. The interesting thing is we know the day and we know the hour. This morning we're going to talk about Jesus' discussion. This was my backup slide in case I couldn't get the video to work. You will notice that all of those guys are Marines. Coincidence? I think not. So this morning we're going to talk about, are we ready or not? Matthew 24, the end of the chapter. In Matthew, Jesus has been giving them signs of their return. We are this morning going to cover the backside of that. The first part of the chapter, Jesus told the disciples that he'd be back. His second coming would be visible to all to see. And in the first half of the chapter, he talks about the outward signs. He says there'll be rumors of wars, there'll be actual wars, there'll be famine, earthquake, persecution, tribulation, false Christs will enter. And then he talks about the celestial witness to his return. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the skies, the power of heaven will be shaken. All these things, Jesus begins to describe what will happen. In verse 30, Matthew goes on Matthew records Jesus kind of putting the period on the end of that section of his discussion of his return. He says, "And then the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky, power and great glory. He'll send forth his angels, a great trumpet. They'll gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. Now learn from the parable of the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and put forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So you too, when you see these things, recognize that he is near, right at the door. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." So he's given them some detailed information about the end of the age, and I suspect at that moment they ran off and they started to draw some charts and some graphs, and they started to plot out the return. How will we know that Jesus is returning? And I'm not anti-charts and graphs. But it seems to me that the Pharisees had charts and graphs about the coming of the Messiah, and they were wrong. And I wonder if sometimes we get caught up on the first half of Matthew 24 and forget the second half in our zeal to plot out the timeline. Jesus, in the second half, turns the telescope around, and he goes from the outward to the inward. Rather than telling us what to expect, he talks about what we should be doing. And so he goes again from the outward sign of his return to our inward readiness. And he says three things about it. He says, first, judgment delayed is not to be mistaken for judgment forgotten. Then he tells them that ready or not, it will be sudden and irreversible. And then finally, he says to them at the end, this is news, not advice. And so start at the beginning again. Judgment delayed is not to be mistaken for judgment forgotten. Jesus says to them, "But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone." Sometimes we can get sidetracked on this verse. Jesus is not giving a doctrinal statement about the Trinity. He's not telling us, here's the difference between the Father and the Son. Here's how the Trinity works. That's not his point. His point is, as he has been saying over and over again in the Gospels, this is God's plan for the reconciliation of all men. He repeats over and over again that he is obeying the plan. He's fulfilling the plan. This is part of the gospel plan. He's not making a commentary on the Trinity as much as he's saying, I am executing the Father's plan that has been in place since the very beginning of creation, that started to unfold at the very moment of the fall. And if you read through the Gospels, how many times does Jesus say, I am obedient to the Father? I do the Father's will. I'm following the Father's command. That's exactly what he's saying here. The end will come, and it will come in the day the Father has set apart for it. Not the day I pick, not the day you pick. The Father knows. He reveals pretty much two truths through this, two great truths in one verse, that his return will happen. It's a sure thing because the Father knows the time. And the Father is sovereign over all things. And so when it says the day and hour that the Father alone knows, that puts an exclamation point on it. It will happen. And his return is intentional and planned. There's a knowing. There's an urgency and an intentional working out of God's plan. Sometimes we think that when something doesn't happen, it won't happen. Or we start to lose our faith, we start to lose our confidence. So what does this mean for our lives right now at this moment in Wake County? How do we take Jesus' assurance that he is operating on God's plan, that God's got all of this in control, and how do we bring it to Wake County? How do we bring it to this room? How does the reality of Jesus' return affect the way I should think and feel right now? Well, the second coming is a very practical doctrine. And Paul wrote to the Thessalonians sometime around 51 AD, and he said a fair amount to them. But about this, he says, we don't want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those who are asleep, so that you will not grieve as do the rest who have no hope. The Thessalonians had thought, man, Jesus, we expected Jesus here by now. We expected him 50 years ago. They lived with the anticipation that Jesus was about to arrive, that every knock at the door could be Jesus' return. And so they'd started to lose hope. And Paul says to them, I don't want you to be uninformed, unaware. I don't want you to be misled, just like those who have no hope. And then he talks about the rapture. He talks about Jesus' coming. And then he summarizes at the very end, says, therefore, comfort one another with these words. The idea that Jesus is returning should be comforting to us today in this place. In our culture, in our experience, in our day, it should be comforting to us that Jesus is coming to bring fulfillment to the Father's plan of reconciliation. That should bring us assurance, and it should help us get through those days that just don't seem to be going right. I was on my way home from work yesterday and driving down the Cary Parkway, and I don't know if your car has one of these, but my car has a thing on it that the light comes on and says, your car is broken, take it to the mechanic right now. And it came on, I was about 2/3 of the way home, and so I chugged home as though I was driving a locomotive or something. But it was not a good experience. Didn't make me feel hopeful for the future. Didn't give me the joy of the return. And I had to remind myself, it's right here, Paul would describe these as momentary light afflictions. This thing's going to pass away. I will forget about this in less time than it takes to fix it. So it's practical to us. It should give us comfort. They believed Jesus would be back any second, and they planned their lives around it. They planned every day with the expectation that Jesus' return was imminent. And so that affected how they lived and how they spoke and how they related to one another, the places they went, the times they stayed, how long they were there, what they did with their money, and how they planned for the future. And they'd become discouraged. They've become kind of fall into the voice of the scoffers, and they thought they'd missed it. Jesus says, you didn't miss it. Keep on anticipating. Keep on living with a hope for the future. And it's almost like he says, you will know when Jesus comes because you'll see all of those knees bending and tongues confessing. It will be obvious. So do not be discouraged. You have not missed it. Peter says the same thing 10 years later. Peter writes to the church and he says, this is now, beloved, the second letter I'm writing to you in which I'm stirring up in you a sincere mind by way of reminder. Remember what the prophet said. And then in verse 11 of 2 Peter chapter 3, he says, but according to his promise, we are looking for a new heaven, a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Peter tells him the same thing. Be of good courage. Be of strength. Be of hope. Jesus will return. It is the Father's plan. We did not miss it. He tells the church, Paul tells the church, and neither have we. So we are to live with a sense of mission, a sense of urgency. We're to be comforted by that truth. And Jesus begins a section now to illustrate that truth. So he says, ready or not, when he returns, it will be sudden and irreversible. And he gives really two illustrations, really three. Talks about the days of Noah, talks about two men and two women. And one thing that strikes us as we read through there, they are marked by a casual indifference and they are distracted by their circumstances. Think about the days of Noah. Jesus tells us something about it. For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying, giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. And they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. So will the coming of the Son of Man be. Jesus says, the people in that day did not know the day that judgment would strike. So what kept them from listening to Noah's message? What kept them from reserving a place on the ark? What kept them from obedience? It was the common interest of life. It's interesting that in Genesis, it describes those times as so evil that God said, I'm going to get a do-over. I'm starting over. The lives of men are continually evil in their hearts. I can't find any reason to keep on this plane. I'm going to rescue a few. I'm going to start over with the rest. Jesus doesn't make any mention of that. What does Jesus point us to? Their everyday life, their everyday circumstances, the things that kind of blinded them to the message, right? It was the common interest of life. Eating, drinking, marrying, giving in marriage. They're going to work. They're coming home. It's business as usual. It's normal. Then all of a sudden, the flood comes and sweeps them away. That's what the second coming will be like. We'll be eating lunch. We'll be making plans. We'll be going through our routines. And to our surprise, that day will be upon us. Notice what Jesus kind of points out to them again. He says, it took them all away. They were taken away in judgment. A division takes place. Some will be rescued and some will not. Some will be left to judgment. It's sudden and it's complete. So there's a picture of a long time of waiting and then a sudden conclusion, a sudden drawing to the end. They were distracted to their destruction. They'll be about their normal business right up till that moment. And the coming of man, just as abrupt. Then he tells in verse 40 and 41, then there will be two men in the field. One will be taken, one will be left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken, one will be left. Notice that Jesus, in good rabbinical fashion, goes from very general to very specific. And he starts to move through it in his illustrations. He talks about Noah, general catastrophe. Then he starts to move it down. There's a woman, a man. And what are they doing? They're in the field. They're at the mill. They're doing the things of commerce, the things of the normal day that they would have. There's no distinction made between them. Their circumstances are kind of the same. They're just busy about the things that they do every day. They're getting up. They're going to work. They're coming home. Repeat the next day. But one is taken. One is left. So the field, the mill, the story, the emphasis is division. And we shouldn't miss the fact that both the stories Jesus tells, they end in judgment. In fact, all the way through this part of the chapter, the illustration ends in judgment. Beware of thinking that our day-to-day stuff, the things of this life, will last. One day, it'll be turned upside down, and it will happen in an instant. And Jesus says, it'll happen when you least expect it. And so should we be ready? Should we be prepared? We talk about fasting, that the self-denial of that. What's the benefit of those disciplines? What's the benefit of that? Reminds us every day, this world is not my home. these circumstances are not the things of my life. But I am in this place for a purpose, and Jesus will draw that out for us. Verse 42, he says, therefore, be on the alert. Because these things are true, be on the alert, for you don't know which day your Lord is coming. Jesus says to them, be ready all the time, every moment. Be constantly prepared. And he uses a tense for urgency, as though there was a fire about to break out. I think sometimes we've been kind of lulled into a different kind of expectation. I ordered something online the other day. I don't know if you ever order anything on Amazon. So they set the expectation, right? You order something on Amazon. By the time you click order, you have an email saying, hey, you ordered something from Amazon. Then 10 minutes later, you get another email saying, hey, we're working on your order. Thanks for using Amazon. 5 minutes later, you get another email. It seems that between the time you order it and the time you get it, you're never unconscious of the fact that you ordered something from Amazon, because they are constantly reminding you of that, right? So the first time that happens, first time you order from them, you think, oh, that's kind of neat. After a year or so of that, you can hardly stand to buy anything anyplace else. I bought a shirt from a guy. He's in Chapel Hill. Okay, it was like a day up the road. He didn't send me any emails. He didn't call me on the phone. I had no idea it was coming. I was pretty freaked out after about a half hour. You know, how will I know that my shirt is coming? When will it arrive? When can I plan to wear it? What does Amazon tell us? You know, you should be thinking about this all the time, because this is coming. And so they remind us over and over and over again. And what does it make us do? It makes us want to buy stuff from Amazon. So it does to me anyway. I love to get emails from people, even if it's Amazon. Think about, how do we remind ourselves? How are we reminded that Jesus is on the way? What does that for me in my life right now that reminds me every day Jesus is on his way? Don't forget. I'm Jesus telling you, hey, I'm thinking about you. Hey, I got your name written down. Hey, I got a place prepared for you. Hey, get ready, because I'm coming to get you. I'll be there to pick you up. I don't know when, but when I show up, have your bags packed. Be ready to go. Jesus says, therefore, be on the alert. Don't be fooled by circumstances. Don't be distracted. Verse 43, but be sure of this, that if the head of the house had known what time at night the thief was coming, he would have been on the alert, would not have allowed his house to be broken into. For this reason also, you must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming in an hour when you do not think he will. Now, I love that Jesus said that. He says, not only do you not know when I'm coming, but I'm coming when you don't think I'm coming. Like when you're on vacation or the day before vacation. I heard, might have been J. Vernon McGee, or I usually attribute things to Spurgeon, but as old as I am, I didn't hear him say this, so it was somebody younger, said, everybody wants Jesus to return the day after they get back from Hawaii. Nobody wants Jesus to return the day before they go to Hawaii. Everybody wants Jesus to come back the day before the calculus test. Nobody wants him to come back the day after graduation, right? Jesus is our life raft. Jesus, I'm not your life raft, I'm your home. I'm coming to rescue you. So he tells him in the story about Noah, nobody knows the day. He tells him in the story of the thief, nobody knows the hour. He's starting to really focus in on them. And he says, guess what? If I told you something bad was going to happen to your stuff, you'd be ready. If I told you a thief was coming to your house to steal your stuff, you'd be preparing. You'd be planning. You'd be watching out. Because your stuff is important to you. If you drive around Cary, try to count how many storage units are being built around town. I'm not sure what that means, but I don't think it's good. Make no doubt about the fact that there is a certainty on which we should plan. Just like Jesus says, we knew the thief was coming, we'd be ready. For this reason also, be ready, for the Son of Man is coming. Be ready. And in the end of the chapter, I believe Jesus tells them that this is news, not advice. And so he says to them, who then is the faithful and sensible slave whom his master has put in charge of the household to give them the food at the proper time? Who's watching out for the thief on behalf of the father? Blessed is that slave whom the master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But if that evil slave says in his heart, my master is not coming for a long time, and begins to beat his fellow slaves and eat and drink with drunkards, The master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him, at an hour which he does not know, and will cut him in pieces, assign him a place with the hypocrites. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Look at how Jesus has really narrowed the focus as he's turned the telescope from the outward to the inward. He's really started to focus in on what's important, right? He started with no one knows the time, the broadest statement. In all eternity, nobody knows the time. Then he talks about the flood, a worldwide catastrophe. So many words to choose from, and I usually pick half of the wrong word. Worldwide catastrophe. Then he says two men, two women, a general description of their casual indifference. Then he says the thief and the homeowner. He starts to talk about personal preparation in your house. Then he talks about the good and the evil servant, and it becomes a you and me, you and him application. He moves from general to specific and really gives us the idea that as he moves from one end to the other, that there are things only God knows, but there are things we should expect. God knows it, but we should expect it, and we should be on our toes. So why is it news and not advice? Martin Lloyd-Jones, in a commentary on 1 Corinthians 15, is talking about the gospel, but it's appropriate for us. He says, advice is counsel about something that hasn't happened yet, but you can do something about it. News is a report about something that has happened, which you can't do anything about because it has been done for you, and all you can do is respond to it. It's kind of what we have here. Paul says the resurrection cemented the fact that Jesus will return, cemented the victory over death. And because that is true, we live in the accomplishment of that. There's nothing we can do to change it. It's something that has been done, and I am called to respond to it. It's not good advice. It's news. Lloyd-Jones has an illustration of the point. He says, in a battle against an invading army, if the enemies have all been defeated and the mission is accomplished, the commanding officer sends back messengers and envoys with a report. Good news, what has already been done. Those carrying the good news are filled with joy, go on living in peace through what has been accomplished for them. On the other hand, if the battle has not been won, the commanding officer sends for military advisors on how to defeat the enemy with new strategies and redoubling their efforts. That's why Paul can tell the Thessalonians, comfort one another with these words. And the point that Jesus is driving to, believers live differently because of what has already been accomplished. Believers watch out because what has already been accomplished. Believers live in a Christ-like manner because of what's been accomplished. Believers get ready because of the truth of what has been accomplished. Jesus started with, the Father knows. The Father knows. It's his plan. And it is going to happen. It's as good as done. So what was the servant's downfall? Look at verse 48. But if that evil slave says in his heart, my master is not coming for a long time, and begins to beat his fellow slaves and eats and drinks with the drunkards, what's the problem? Something went wrong in his heart. When it talks about his heart, it talks about his innermost being. It's the thing that governs his actions. He stopped expecting the master's return. He lived like he had plenty of time, mistreated his fellow servants. It was completely outside his thinking. When we were first married, Sue would go visit her parents occasionally. And when we lived down here, Sue would take the kids and go to Connecticut and visit her parents, and I would be home alone. And depending on how long she was gone, determined how long it took me to prepare the house for her return. So I really had to know, like, what day, morning or afternoon, when will you be back, and where is the vacuum, and where is the sink, and what do I do with these dishes? Because depending on how long she was gone, the house was really not prepared for her return. So it was important for me to know the day and the hour, and then I thought I'd catch up at the last minute. And I suspect that really is a statement on my whole life, because I am deadline-driven, right? To me, the deadline is the day I have to be done by, not the day I plan for, right? So, you know, anything that can be put off should be put off, kind of thing. That's the picture I get from these slaves. The evil slave forgot the master was coming back, but maybe he thought, well, I'll hear about the master's out on the road somewhere, and I'll get a heads up, and I'll be able to get all my stuff back together before he actually arrives home. He wasn't caring about the master's stuff. In fact, Jesus says, I'm the good shepherd. The shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. A hireling doesn't care about the sheep. A hireling runs away. Jesus says, the good slave, he's about the master's business. The evil slave, he's about his own pleasure. He's about his own circumstances. He's about his own things. So there's a great warning. When Jesus returns, our hearts will be exposed. The evil slave said in his heart, my master is not coming for a long time. Notice the good slave. Who then, verse 45, who then is the faithful and sensible slave whom his master put in charge of his household to give them food at the proper time? Jesus starts with who? Who is that person? He invites us to reflection, to address our own readiness. It reminds me of Isaiah chapter 6, where after seeing the glory of God laid out before him, God says, who will we send? And what does Isaiah say? Send me. I'm your guy. I've seen it. I'm ready to go. Jesus says the same thing to us. Who is the good servant? Who among us is the good servant? Who is looking out for the best interests of the kingdom without worrying about my own circumstances? Who here is putting the kingdom above my comfort? Verse 46, he says, blessed is that slave whom the master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you, he will be put in charge of all the possessions. What's Jesus saying? Hey, that guy, I'll be happy with him. He'll be the good and faithful servant. He will come and sit at my table. He doesn't know when the master is going to return, but he doesn't seem to care one bit about it because he is concerned about the master's work. He's looking after the master's possessions, and he's engaged in that no matter when the master returns. He's so committed to the task that he's not watching the clock, he's not watching the calendar, but he's expecting his return. Look at the evil slave, verse 50. The master of that slave will come on a day when he doesn't expect him, at an hour which he does not know, and he'll cut him to pieces, assign him a place with the hypocrites. In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Jesus underlines the truth that delay does not mean cancellation. Because it hasn't happened yet doesn't mean it won't happen. He took longer than expected to return. The slave turned to his own thoughts and to his own comfort. Look at the punishment. Cut him to pieces. Assign him a place with the hypocrites. All through the Gospels, the hypocrites come under severe condemnation, and it's usually the Pharisees, right? Jesus calls them hypocrites. You're pretending to be religious. You're pretending to be concerned about the coming of the Messiah. You're pretending to do the work of God, but you're really about your own stuff. You're really about your own position, your own power, your own authority. He says, that evil slave, he'll be assigned the place with the hypocrites. Who's Jesus talking to here? He's talking to his disciples. He's talking to the people he's about to leave. And what does he say? You'll be assigned with the Pharisees. He holds them to the same standard he holds the Pharisees to. He says, I'm going to assign you to that place. In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Proverbial expression. Matthew uses it several times. We know intuitively that that's the place of anguish and suffering for those who are lost, the place of separation from God. And so Jesus gives them through illustration and through the story the idea that a judgment is coming, separation is coming. One group comes and spends eternity in heaven. The other group goes off to eternal torment and to suffering. He says, be ready. Part of being ready is a profession of faith in Jesus Christ, and part of being ready is living as he lived, is to proclaim the gospel, to look after his kingdom, be good stewards of what he's given us, to be outward focused as well as inwardly ready. So as we head to Easter, we're reminded that the resurrection is the great and final victory over death. But the return of Jesus is the final consummation of that victory. It's the time when all those things will be put in place. The church has known for 2,000 years that Jesus is returning. And I wonder if we have not become lethargic and drowsy in that knowledge. Because the evidence of that would be an ineffective witness, a failure to win the lost, a failure to share the gospel. So two themes emerge. All the stories start and end with judgment, and all the stories bring us to the idea of not to be fooled by circumstances. I read this story that I think really drives the point home to us. So you know what feral pigs are? They are overrunning many places in the country. Texas is full of them. Eastern North Carolina is full of them. They're destructive. I mean, I think a litter of pigs is some unbelievable number, and they have a litter like every couple days, it seems. I mean, there's bazillions of pigs out there. So how do professional trappers do the job of, of controlling feral pig population. You can't kill them one at a time. You can't trap them one at a time. They evade humans pretty quickly. They're pretty wily. So how do you take care of them? They kill them with kindness. So the story is that first they clear a place in the woods and they build an enclosure. It's a square 20 by 20. It's 4 feet tall. And it's got a door on each of the four walls. It's got an entrance in and out. They load it up with corn and pig delicacies. And they leave it there. And at first, and this is the author's words, at first the suspicious hogs send in a few of their little ones as scouts. That is wrong right there. Who goes in? The dad pig? Nope. Go ahead, Junior, see what's going on in there. At first, the suspicious hogs send in a few of the little scouts. The scouts come and go at will, eating to their piggy satisfaction, until eventually suspicion dies and they are joined by every other member of the herd right up the chain of command. The pigs soon come to believe that if nothing bad has happened, nothing bad will happen, and their normalcy bias kicks in. They begin to think of their situation as normal and ongoing and permanent. Soon the pigs can't imagine any other life. Rooting for tubers, unpleasant task of the forgotten past. Nightly, the herd eagerly trots into free corn in the pen, and they fail to notice that when one night, one of the doors has been closed off. Nights later, a second door is closed off. The author makes the remark that pigs are as smart as dogs, but neither one can count, so they have no idea how many gates there were at first. Till the third gate is closed off, there's only one opening left. And then the trapper puts a spring-loaded gate, and when the entire herd is in, he closes the pen. And with a metallic clang, the miraculous corn nirvana turns into a death trap. We are being hunted by an enemy who will lure us in and change our normalcy bias and draw us away from our king. And before we know it, the trap has sprung. And those things we thought were normal, those circumstances, those comings and goings that go to work and come home, it will be too late. Two questions before we end. Am I keeping watch for Jesus, and am I faithfully following Jesus? His return should be on our minds, in our hearts, in such a way that it touches every corner of our lives, every plan we make, every dollar we spend, every dollar we save, every place that we go. His return should be on our minds. We should be thinking about it. We should be tuned into it. And maybe at this time of year, as we talk about fasting, as we talk about Easter coming, maybe this is the best time of year to remind ourselves that this is what's happening. You know, the idea of fasting, every time you get hungry, you think about Jesus is returning. You think about, am I a good servant? Am I spreading the gospel? Am I speaking the truth to a lost world? Or am I worried about myself? Am I keeping watch for Jesus? And then the second question, am I faithfully following Jesus? And really, that's best answered by a series of questions. How would I live differently today if I knew Jesus was coming back today? Will I be found walking in obedience to him when he returns, or will I be found wandering in disobedience? Will I be found sharing the gospel or remaining silent? Will I be found loving my neighbor or ignoring my neighbor? Will we be found passionately devoted to our spouse or practically negligent of our spouse? Will we be found hating sin or holding on to sin? It's not an attempt to earn our keep or to justify ourselves. Rather, it's a demonstration of our love for Jesus, our gratitude for what he's given to us, and our sanctification as we become more and more and more like Jesus himself. Will we be commended for our love or condemned by our laziness? I'll be in the response room when we're done. If you want to talk about how we can live with anticipation of his return, how we can use these days between now and Easter to rekindle a sense of urgency, a desire for Jesus' return. If you want to talk about how you can know which side of that judgment you're on, are you in the ark? Are you taken? Are you left? Which slave are you? Because it all starts with a understanding that Jesus rescues us from sin. It all starts with Jesus' payment on our behalf for the sin that sends us to judgment. And we escape that judgment through Jesus' death on the cross, through his resurrection, that which we will celebrate. When Paul wrote, he wrote to the church. He wrote to believers. When Peter wrote, he wrote to believers. Jesus is talking to his disciples. But what they all knew was that there are those who are destined for judgment to whom this makes absolutely no sense. So maybe we need to talk about, what does that really mean? How do I get on the right side of that equation of judgment? Or how do I tell others about that? How do I share my faith? I'll be in the response room. If you want to come and talk about those things, I'd love for you to come by and let's chat for a few minutes. But let's pray. Father, I thank you that you have preserved your word for generations to let us know, to remind us that you love us, that you see us, that you hear us, that you are returning for us, that you have planned for us, that you love us, that you care for us, Father, and remind us that you have given us work to do in your kingdom, that you have called us to speak and to love and to go, Father, to care and to live with an urgency of your return, an urgency for your glory, an urgency for your kingdom. Father, that comes from our love for you, which is the return of your love for us. Reveal to us anew your glory, your love, your care for us, Father. Set our hearts aflame that we would not be distracted by circumstances, but that we would hear your voice above all others. And we ask it in the name of our King, the one who brings our victory, Jesus Christ. Amen. We are dismissed.
Thank you for listening to the Salem Baptist Church podcast. For more information about Salem, please visit our website at salem-bc.org.